Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and hosted by Eli Mazur. If you enjoyed listening, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting app, share it with others, and leave a 5-star rating. And if you're not already a regular IP Watchdog reader, check it out and sign up for the email list to get daily updates. This episode features an interview with Brian Pomper of the Innovation Alliance. Thomas Edison, the Wright brothers, and Charles Goodyear are some of America's best-known innovators. Instead of just making and selling the final products, they obtain patents and license their innovations to manufacturers. American companies like IBM, Qualcomm, and Dolby have followed this great American tradition of focusing on innovation. However, the patent troll narrative has undermined the idea that innovators should be incentivized and rewarded for their efforts. A string of Supreme Court decisions and the passage of the American Invents Act were part of an effort to deal with the so-called patent troll problem. Around the time that the AIA was being debated in Congress, a diverse group of technology companies that focus on research and development formed the Innovation Alliance Educate DC Policymakers. And Brian Pomper, a registered patent attorney who worked for several years on Capitol Hill, became the executive director of Innovation Alliance shortly after it was started. During this episode, Brian discusses the number one way to improve the patent system, what unites the Innovation Alliance, how the Innovation Alliance tried to improve the AIA, continued efforts to restrict patent rights, why there's still hope for legislative action to fix patent eligibility, the impact that the COVID-19 pandemic is having on the patent policy debate, and much more.
Do you remember when you first became aware of patents, and what role did you think they played at the time?
So I guess I'm unusual in the world of lobbying because I have a degree in mechanical engineering, right? I have an engineering background. So I think of myself a little bit as a math and science guy and really have for a really long time. I didn't become an engineer. In fact, I went straight from college into law school because I really was incompetent as an engineer. I mean, truly, I tell young people now when they're contemplating going to engineering school, I ask them, it's not enough just to really enjoy math and science and the sort of theoretical components, but you really have to have that kind of spatial understanding, fixing engines, you know, are you the sort of person who, you know, loves to build things or rip things apart? You know, those are the people I think who are good at engineering. I have trouble turning on a light switch by myself.
The story of a lot of patent attorneys. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Steve knows I am totally technologically incompetent. And so rushed into law school. But even so, in law school, I always thought, you know, because I have this math and science interest, I thought maybe I'll be a patent attorney. And so I spent a summer in law school working at a now defunct patent firm called Morgan & Finnegan up in New York. Then came back to law school, decided I wanted to be an international trade lawyer. So that's really where I ended up focusing my time. I worked after law school, I clerked for a judge. And after that, I worked at Skadden Arps, really at doing international trade and litigation type work, including some patent litigation. And that's when I took the patent bar and became, I guess, in the eyes of the world, a patent lawyer, as well as what I otherwise do. And so I worked on Capitol Hill. I was a trade lawyer. I became a lobbyist. And there was...
And I guess, before you went on Capitol Hill, what did you think of patents and the role they played? I guess, what was your experience with them?
Sure. Well, I was the chief international trade counsel on the Senate Finance Committee. So patents were important from the standpoint of we, on the Finance Committee, you know, you're talking about international patent policy in the context of trade agreements that we were negotiating, but also you are ensuring enforcement of existing obligations. So I can't think of any specific examples, honestly, but I mean, when you are sitting in that seat as the chief trade counsel, at least I always thought my job was to represent American workers, American companies overseas. And so if countries had agreed to abide by certain criteria, certain obligations, if they're members of the TRIPS obligations apply to them, or if we've got a bilateral trade agreement that have different or further objectives or further obligations, it was our job to try to encourage that country by hook or by crook to live up to its obligations to help American workers and companies, right? So in that context, I always thought about helping American companies as they competed in an international context, that their intellectual property rights was something that was important to them.
How would you describe, when you, during your time in Capitol Hill, the awareness of most members of Congress about patent issues? And I guess, what was their reaction when they found out you're a registered patent attorney? I don't know if you ever shared that.
It's funny. I do a lot of work in these two somewhat separate areas. There's some overlap, but I do a lot of work on the international trade side still. And of course, I'm quite active on patent policy too. But the different groups of people who I know in those different groups don't necessarily know the other half of my, you know, existence. Oh. So on Capitol Hill, I don't know that members knew, you know, that I had this experience. I will say now there are some senators. I tend to focus more on the Senate than the House because, of course, I was a Senate staffer.
Yeah.
But some senators who I've become friendly with, they joke about the fact that I have this degree from MIT, which is unusual in what I do, right? So they kind of give me a hard time about it. So they know, and they know I have that kind of tech patent background. So there was, I remember, an issue I worked with, actually Ryan Triplett. That's how I got to know Ryan Triplett. I don't know if you remember that name. Interestingly, she ultimately ended up being one of the primary lobbyists on the other side of the patent issue for...
Yeah, I've talked to her before.
Yeah, and you know, she's an old friend, and I wish her all the best. I think she lives in France now. She was, I think, studying to be like a sommelier, like a wine, she's a real enophile. Anyway, she was working for Senator Spector when I worked for Senator Baucus, and we were trying to, like, she had a constituent company that had an issue with in Turkey on a patented product. And I remember working with her quite a bit in Senator Spector's office on that. But that's just the concrete example of how, you know, we as the trade committee would be working with companies and other senators and to try to make sure that their constituents' rights would be met in the international arena.
And so you left Congress in about 2006, and that's really when the patent troll narrative was starting to heat up. When did you become aware that, I guess, effort to limit patent troll activity?
I left Capitol Hill at the end of 2006, and I founded or co-founded an all-Democratic lobby firm then called Parvin Pomper Schuyler. The idea, we thought that Democrats were going to be more important after the election in 2006, because at that time, the House, the Senate, the White House was all Republican. And we thought that moderate Democrats were going to be in a demand commodity, because we sort of thought, oh gosh, you know, maybe the House, Democrats will take the House. And of course, the Democrats took the House and the Senate, and then subsequently the White House 2 years later. So it was I joke sometimes in life, it's better to be lucky than good. We had this all Democratic lobby firm. One of our clients early on was then called the Biotechnology, what are they even called? Biotechnology Industry Organization. Now it's Biotechnology Innovation Organization.
Yeah.
And as part of that, I went to the bio convention that was in Boston in 2007 because I had this interest in patents. I hadn't been doing any work on it. I went to one of the, I don't know if you've ever been to the bio convention. I strongly recommend it. It is quite something to see, you know, 15,000 people in the gigantic Boston Convention Center. It was just amazing to me. And I was new to what I do now. And so it really blew my mind away. But I went to a panel that was on patents. And what I remember about that, it was Hans Sauer, who then and now, of course, still is with Bio. And he was laying out the various proposals that were being considered. And I always joke with Hans now, and Bio is a client again, still, like I should say again now for me on the international side. So I do talk to Hans from time to time, and I joke with him now that he taught me everything I needed to know about that panel. But so that's when I first learned there was this big brewing battle in 2007. I guess then it was hot and heavy. But I wasn't super involved. I helped Bio a little bit, or tried to help Bio a little bit, just setting up meetings, but I wasn't super involved. It wasn't really until the fall of 2008, I was approached by a very old friend who I knew from trade policy circles, a USTR alumnus named Sean Murphy, who was then at Qualcomm, who, again, I knew because he was a trade policy guy. And he, you know, he'd lobbied me when I was on Capitol Hill. He came to Montana when we launched the Korea Round of Free Trade Agreement. I talked to him quite a bit there. So he, of course, when he was at Qualcomm, helped put together, along with a bunch of companies, some of whom remain members, some of whom merged, some no longer exist, founded the Innovation Alliance. And so I think they were founded maybe 2006, 2007, thereabouts.
And were they founded specifically because they knew this, I guess, the American Invents Act or some version of it was being debated at the time?
I think they were. I of course, was not present at the creation. So but I believe they were founded because the companies in the Innovation Alliance are high-tech companies. But they make a significant portion, many of them, of their income from licensing, patent licensing. So they're I call them innovation factories, right? These are companies who are, like Dolby is a great example, or Qualcomm, and they're 75% engineers in terms of their employees. And so they come up with these incredibly innovative ideas. They patent them and then they license them broadly, but they don't often manufacture it themselves. So at the time, I think the general idea or the kind of the top line description of what the patent debate was about in 2007 or so was, oh, this is tech versus pharma. Now, of course, that was never true in the sense that at that point, it was tech versus pharma, other tech companies, manufacturers, universities, venture capital. I mean, you name it, right? It was back when a portion of the damages was the big issue. I don't know if you were working on it back then, but that's a long time ago. But still, the way it was understood in the popular culture on Capitol Hill was, oh, it's tech versus pharma. And the Innovation Alliance companies looked at each other and said, hey, we're tech companies, but we actually align with pharma in that we want a robust, strong patent system. We think patents are important to us. That's what we're selling when we license our technologies. We don't have products that we're selling. We're not patent aggregators. You know, we're not taking all sorts of patents, our own and others, putting it into a product and then selling it. We are selling our ideas. And so they were very sensitive to how the patent system protected their inventions. And so they got together, and I think they were in existence for about a year or so, and decided, you know, we need somebody who can try to help make the trains run on time, because Sean was sort of serving that role, but, you know, he had work he had to do for Qualcomm. And it was, I think, they decided they wanted a neutral party who would sit in the middle and be able to, you know, negotiate out issues without, you know, people feeling like, oh, that's, you know, Amber Wave is, they're just doing it for their purposes, or Cummins Allison, or these other companies, right? So they interviewed me and hired me in early 2009. And so I have been the executive director of the Innovation Alliance since then. And last thing I'll tell you in that vein, Elias, I remember, because I didn't really know anything about the politics of the patent debate, or frankly, even really much of the substance at the time. But, you know, Sean, I think when the Innovation Alliance companies decided they needed somebody to be an executive director, Sean was the one who said, you know, I do know this guy who is a Midwesterner, and I always like to say Midwesterners, my superpower is that I get along with almost everybody, right? That's like my Midwestern superpower. And, you know, he has a patent, he's a member of the patent bar, he's got a technical background, you know, he might be somebody good. So they decided to hire me as the executive director. And I was talking to a friend of mine, because I was a little nervous about this. And I said, my God, I mean, talk about high stakes. And you know, there's all these different associations and companies fighting, and they had been fighting for a year by that point. But how am I just going to jump into this and help lead this coalition when I'm just brand new to this? I don't know where all the political fault lines are, all that stuff. And a friend of mine gave me very good advice. He said, look, just, you know the substance, just trust your instincts. And sure enough, like anything, once you get in and you're kind of in the trenches, you sort of understand, or you come to understand, where the different players are, where they're coming from, where the fault lines are, what are the substantive issues. And so I've really been doing it ever since.
And I want to talk about the dynamics between your members. I think that's an interesting topic. But I guess going back to AIA, coincidentally, your current colleague at Akin Gump, Lamar Smith, was the one who led that effort. He introduced the first version of that bill in 2005. And then by 2011, it passed, which to me, it seems really quick. Even you as a patent attorney who was on Capitol Hill didn't even know this was, it seemed, bubbling up until somebody reached out to you. Looking back, are you surprised how quickly it happened?
Yeah, I don't think it was that quick. I mean, legislation often takes years. And so, you know, I think it was roughly, you know, 5 or 6 years where it was, and several Congresses. I think that's pretty typical with major legislation like that. But yeah, I sometimes will give Lamar a hard time. He's a lovely person, truly, has absolutely the best of intentions. You know, I just sort of rib him that, you know, it's okay to be wrong sometimes, you know, on some of his issues, you know. So, but he's great. I'm happy to work with him.
And I guess it's fair to say when you got involved in 2009, I mean, you were pretty outmatched and outgunned, I guess, your side. The final vote comes down and it's 304 to 117 and 89 to 9 in the Senate. And I guess, you know, one way to look at it is obviously those numbers are lopsided. But if you look at the people who voted no, and I took a look at the list again today, it's, you know, you had it was a bipartisan group of people. You had conservative Republicans, members of the Congressional Black Caucus. There were some progressive members who I'm sure thought the bill didn't go far enough. And even Henry Waxman, who pushed the, you know, the Hatch-Waxman bill, voted against it. I mean, I guess, what did you think when those votes happened? Did you feel any sort of satisfaction? I guess, how would you rate your performance in that, that battle?
To be clear, I don't think the Innovation Alliance at the end of the day opposed the American Invents Act. There were parts of it that we were not crazy about. And I would say specifically the inter-parties review system that was put into place, we were nervous because we were concerned that it was susceptible to abuse. In terms of, you know, how did the Innovation Alliance perform during that period? I think it was not just us. There were plenty of people, you know, working with us. But if you look at, you know, how that debate played out, you had, first of all, injunctive relief, I think, was the first thing that the other side of this debate, whatever you want to call it, High Tech Coalition for Patent Fairness, that was the thing they were trying to get. And then they ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled in a way that was very beneficial to them.
Yeah.
And so their first, that was their primary ask. Then it moved on to apportionment of damages. I think the broad community was able to defeat that maneuver, that idea. And once they defeated that idea, I think the bill was headed towards passage. But we still had concerns in the sense of how the post-grant system was being set up. This is really ancient history, but it's interesting because there was as we were saying things like, look, you got to have strong collateral estoppel. You have to have safeguards in how the system works because companies invest a lot of money when they get a patent to develop the patent. And if that patent can continually be challenged, or there can be a cloud of uncertainty hanging over this patent, companies are going to be reluctant to invest that, you know, a ton of money in, or think a ton of money in a patent that could be, you know, taken away like that. There needs to be some sort of quiet title or some safeguards around this. And so as we were making this argument, there was a patent firm, I don't know where they were, out of California or something, that issued basically what looked was like a business development document. They called themselves patent assassins. Do you ever hear about this, Eli?
Was that the first version of unified patents? No, I don't.
I don't know who they were, but they literally called themselves patent assassins. Steve, this may have predated you. Yeah. But it literally said things like, we guarantee we're going to knock out the patent because we can have, you know, an infinite number of challenges. And like all the things we were worried about, these guys were saying, hey, we can sell this and we're going to kill patents. And you know, you incumbent tech guys, you can go out and do whatever you want. And so we use that to go up to Capitol Hill and say, listen, like, this is what we're worried about. This is not a theoretical concern. And to their credit, the people who were really running the show at that time, Joe Mattel in particular, I think, and some others, understood, okay, that makes sense. And they did make some of the changes that, not all of them, but some of the changes, they put in some of the safeguards that we wanted in inter partes review. Not all of them, but, you know, some of them. And so as adjusted, the bill then passed. So I think the Innovation Alliance did have, you know, it's got its fingerprints on the American Invents Act, I think, in a, you know, reasonably positive way.
Well, I guess in retrospect, then, two questions. I'm surprised to hear that the Innovation Alliance, I guess, was fine with the passage of the American Indents Act as a whole or didn't oppose it.
As I remember, I don't know that we either supported or opposed it. We may have been neutral because we were worried about the post-grant stuff.
Yeah.
But we wanted to acknowledge that there were changes that were made to come our way in our positioning. And so we didn't oppose it, is what I recall.
Well, I guess would you say now that the passage of it was a mistake? And if so, in retrospect, is there anything that could have been done differently, I guess, in that fight? Because it's always easier to stop a bill than to pass a bill, I would think. But
I mean, the centerpiece from many policymakers' point of view and even stakeholders' point of view of the AIA was moving from first to invent to first to file. From that standpoint, I don't think the IA companies have really ever, it's never really been an issue we have focused on much. I know there are quite a few smaller inventors that, you know, we will often liaise with. I mean, we talk often to stakeholders out there, and I think some of them are still chafing at that change, but that's not been an issue that we really had.
Yeah.
So do I think passing the AIA was a mistake? No, I think it would have been better, I think, for more of these safeguards to be put into place. I think it probably would have been better in some ways in legislation to mandate the Phillips standard, for instance, the claim construction standard for inter-parties reviews. And we would have, I think, avoided a whole couple of years of heartache in how that, you know, how the PTAB implemented that system. That maybe would be something, if I could go back in time, I would say we should do that. Although I don't know if that specific issue, I know that the standard of review was one of the things that we wanted and we didn't get, I believe, in the terms of safeguards. But long way of saying, if I go back in time, I would love to, with 2020 hindsight, put some more of the safeguards into the IPR system, some of which I think we advocated for at the time and some of which I don't know that even we could have foreseen.
Yeah. And you talked about one of your jobs, stepping into this role, Executive Director of Innovation Alliance, was to kind of navigate between your member companies and to try to reach a consensus. Has it been easier or harder than you thought it would be? And are there, can you give any examples of issues where you don't take positions on because they kind of go their separate ways?
Yeah, I don't know about the not taking positions part. Yeah. It's hard to think of a negative, I guess, but in any organization, I guarantee you, you talk to anybody who serves in a similar or analogous role where there are institutions sitting around a table who generally agree, but nevertheless, there's individual personalities and they have their own point of view and their companies have their own, you know, biases and perspectives and priorities. It can be a challenge to try to get everybody on the same page. So sometimes something so simple as we're going to issue a press release and what does it say? You know, the wordsmithing can sometimes be really challenging. Steve, you know, could agree with me here on this. But those sorts of things, I think, and certainly trying to come up with legislative text can be very challenging because people, again, they've got their different approaches. But that's the goal of somebody like me, is to try to drive the process to get to a common result.
I think that's kind of interesting. So let's say there's some issue being debated on Capitol Hill, and let me know if that's not how the process works. You think it's important to your member companies from an IP standpoint. You think you should put out a press release. Then do you have to get approval from all your member companies? How does that process work?
Sure. I mean, you got to make sure that you are representing the coalition. Yeah, I would say some of the time it's us, you know, the lobbyists here in DC who work on this stuff, sort of presenting it to the group. Sometimes it's the group, the lawyers, saying, hey, here's this decision that we really care a lot about. Not necessarily something, you know, we focus on, we're a small organization. We don't have teams of lawyers writing amicus briefs for every patent case that goes to the Federal Circuit or the Supreme Court. But, you know, when there are decisions that, you know, the some of the folks in the group care about, we'll issue a press release or we'll talk about it. We'll figure out what, if anything, we should do as follow up, that sort of thing. Or what does it mean? We'll debate what does it mean for the future of the patent system, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And even putting Innovation Alliance aside, but I observe a lot in DC, there's these big groups, but they almost never take a position. They never want to upset anybody. But from an effectiveness standpoint, I mean, if I was one of these companies, I think Brian knows what we represent. Brian knows what our shared goals are. Let's let him just run with it. He's not saying all the member companies support every single thing we do, but, you know.
Yeah, I think over time, the companies, and again, I think this is true not just for this group, but for any group that, that has worked together. And I think over time, you get to a level of trust where they, people kind of know where you are, know how you operate. And so, you know, like just a very mundane example, I don't necessarily draft a press release and send it out and say, okay, I need affirmative approval from absolutely everybody.
Yeah.
It's more, if you object, let me know. So very mundane, but.
No, that's, I think that people who work day to day know that's a big difference in how you operate. And I guess for your members now, what would you say is the number one problem that they do want to solve in the patent system?
There are a few major problems that we see in the patent system. Some obvious ones like Section 101. Everybody, of course, is focused on 101. That's a real concern. And I think, and it really should be a concern for policymakers, because I believe that we, the United States, are hamstringing ourselves a little bit. And I worry about that. Again, remember, I'm an international guy, right? I'm an international trade lawyer. So I look at what's happening in China and other countries around the world. I don't want to sound alarmist, but I do worry, because there are countries that are, they're gunning for us. You know, they are investing heavily in the parts of our economy that are the most innovative and the most promising for the future. And many of those very same areas are those where it's difficult to get patents in the present, I think, absolutely muddled jurisprudence of the Supreme Court on Section 101. So I'll say that's a major concern. But that, the Innovation Alliance hosted a panel with a bunch of folks on the House side in late February, back before the world changed and, you know, you could do those sorts of things. The moderator, who was Mike Waring from the University of Michigan, asked the panelists, if you could change one thing in the patent system, what would you change? And we had talked about a whole bunch of different things. We talked about codifying the Phillips standard instead of leaving it to administrative action by Andre Iancu, all sorts of things. And everybody gave the same answer. And that answer was fixing eBay. And what does fixing mean? It doesn't necessarily mean overturning eBay.
And by eBay, you mean the decision related to injunctions?
Yes, the decision related to injunctions. Because I think from the way that we have seen how eBay operates, and again, we are, you know, heavily licensing model companies, the way that we see how eBay operates, I mean, if you look at, not to get too in the weeds, but if you look at the decision, right, it's a unanimous decision by Justice Thomas. And I would say the takeaway from eBay.
Can't take the lawyer out of you.
You can't. Yeah, that's right. But, you know, the key takeaway was there are no categorical rules. Now, there were several concurrences, if you know that opinion. And there's a reason why I'm going through this. So I'll tie it together. You had Chief Justice Roberts write a concurring opinion who said, yeah, you're right, there should be no categorical rules. And maybe so there shouldn't be automatic injunctions like there had been. But, you know, we did do automatic injunctions for 150 years or so, or 200 years. So, you know, the sentiment of his concurring opinion really was patent owners really should get these injunctions more often than they should. I'm paraphrasing. That's how I read the concurring opinion. He was kind of leaning that way. Justice Kennedy wrote a concurring opinion that was very different and said, basically, look, the world has changed in the modern world. Maybe we shouldn't be giving these folks. In fact, actually, I should say Chief Justice Roberts even pointed out the fact that there are entities that don't manufacture products, like universities, who are just as entitled to injunctions. And we have to make it a case-by-case basis. But he seemed to be saying, okay, this decision doesn't mean those guys shouldn't be getting injunctions anymore. And it was Justice Kennedy who said, yeah, actually, you know, that's like everything has changed now in a modern technological world, and maybe they shouldn't be getting patents anymore. The way we see how the world has developed at the Innovation Alliance is that most courts seem to be applying Kennedy's concurrence, not Thomas's majority opinion. And so there appears to be a nearly categorical rule that if you are simply licensing your patent as opposed to selling a product that practices the patent, it's almost impossible for you to get an injunction. Why is that such a problem? I know the other side of this debate will say, though, that's fantastic, because now patent trolls, you know, they can't shake us down, they can't extort money from us in litigation. I will say from our perspective, The problem for that is, what on earth is the incentive for an infringing company to do anything other than drag us out forever? Basically saying, look, I know you want me to take a license. You say that I'm infringing your patent. I disagree. Go sue me. And so you have, you know, oftentimes years of negotiation.
Yeah. And just to chime in, your member companies can afford that.
That's probably true. I mean, look, they're big companies. But
I'm saying there's a lot of other patent owners who can't even afford to go play that game.
100%. This is where I'm going with this question, Eli, right? Because I'm riffing on it. We do collaborate quite a bit with a bunch of other groups. So we are very close to universities and venture capitalists and the medical device industry, and lots of individual inventors. I mean, we are active in the patent stakeholding community. And I think this concept, which you know what it's called, is efficient infringement, which is grown up in a post-eBay world. It's empowered in the eBay world. It gives the problem with eBay in the context of how it's been interpreted by the courts is that it has shifted negotiating leverage, which I would have argued was balanced for a very long time. And, you know, there's a lot of interactions out there that never resulted in litigation. The vast majority of patents and transactions were fine and worked fine. And sure, there's some litigation, but basically I think the system worked. There were absolutely bad actors. There were abuses. I would say there are abuses in any system. And you have to be careful when you try to squeeze out those abuses that the harm is not worse than the cure. Or so the cure is not worse than the harm. So what we've done now, or what the Supreme Court has done in its decision, is it has shifted the balance of power in such a way that so much of the power belongs to infringers. Where if a patent gives the right to exclude, which is of course what the patent is, it's an exclusive right. But the remedy is you can't keep somebody from using your patent. It's very hard to negotiate something that's really fair. And it has the impact of dragging these disputes out. I think it actually probably leads to more litigation than less, candidly. And it depresses the value of the patent. And that is, I think, fundamentally what folks on the other side will, I mean, I think that they know that, and I think that's their design. And for us, I think that's a real disservice, not just to my companies or small inventors or universities who deal with this stuff, but I think that's a real disservice to the whole system. What I really would love to say, I know I'm babbling a lot here, Eli, but I really do approach this from the standpoint of like, what should U.S. policy be? What's best U.S. policy? And I really do believe genuinely to my heart of hearts that U.S. policy is best served by having strong patent rights. I think that's historically what the United States has had. I think that has served us extremely well. I think it's going to be our comparative advantage going forward in the future. It's not that we're not going to invent things. People are inventive. It's how much money are you going to invest to really develop your inventions and create products and services on the basis of those. So that's my point of view and how I come at these issues.
And I think it's interesting you mentioned that those who support restricting patent rights to deal with quote-unquote patent trolls, they had some major victories before AIA was even passed with that eBay decision, a bunch of other Supreme Court decisions. And when AIA was passed, you'd think they'd just declare victory, say, you know, the system is balanced and let's move on. But they kept pushing. One of your first pieces for IP Watchdog was about the Obama administration supporting those efforts. I guess two questions. Were you surprised about how they were just as outraged about patent trolls before all this happened as after all the successes they had? And second is, why do you think the Obama administration was so focused on these issues?
Yeah, to be fair to the other side of this debate, they would say, oh, well, the AIA was all about what happens before you get the patent. And the Innovation Act that they were pushing during the Obama administration was about patent litigation. I personally thought the Innovation Act was a terrible mistake. I'm glad that it died because it sought at every step of the way, from getting a patent to, like, say, since it's post-patent, but like to getting discovery, to filing suits, to really just anything along the way. It assumed anybody who was trying to sue on a patent was a patent troll, which of course is a vanishingly small percentage of patent owners act this way. And so to to have a bill designed for the entire system, assuming that, you know, you, anybody who's trying to assert a patent is a patent troll, I thought was terrible policy. And fortunately, ultimately, I think policymakers agree. So was I disappointed that the Obama administration supported it? Absolutely.
I guess why were they so, I guess, focused on these issues?
I grew up in Chicago, right? So Barack Obama was my home state senator. I supported him for president when everybody else thought Hillary Clinton was going to win back in the day, because he was my home state senator. And how often can you support your home guy? So I was really disappointed he went the way he did. Am I surprised? In retrospect, maybe not. I would think, look, Facebook was founded in when, 2006? I mean, a lot of these companies, they were already big. I mean, Apple, of course, was already gigantic, but they really hit their stride in that mid-2000s era. And so when Obama came into office, these companies were, they're super ascendant now. So it's hard to say they're not ascendant now. But I mean, these companies were, I guess, newer, and everybody thought they were fantastic. I remember somebody saying, oh, you know, President Obama just thinks Eric Schmidt hung the moon. Eric Schmidt can do no wrong. And, you know, these companies, that's innovation in America. And I'm not saying they're not. They are great American companies. And I want them to succeed. I want them to continue hiring and employing U.S. workers. But I think that their view of how the patent system should work and how their business models work is fundamentally inconsistent with, you know, companies who are focused on innovation activities that are patent dependent. You know, these companies, again, I want to emphasize this, they're great American companies. I love them all. I have friends all over the place there, right? I want them to succeed. But their business model isn't about selling, you know, patented inventions like ours is. You know, Google makes a ton of money from its advertising business and Amazon from sales, you know, Dell making computers. Their business models are such that weakening the patent system, from my perspective, benefits their business. And so, of course, that's what they were trying to do during the course of the Obama administration. I was very disappointed the Obama administration embraced that. But I think by the end of the administration, I think it became clearer that there were lots of other voices out there who were just as innovative as a lot of these companies who really relied on the patent system for those innovations. And so I think towards the end of the administration, it got to be much more of a balanced view, which is maybe why the Innovation Act didn't ultimately pass.
What do you think contributed to that shift in attitude? I guess not. We've probably seen it even more since.
They have a ton of hard work, right? I mean, it's
Brian Pomper, right?
No, I mean, I'm the last person to take credit. Truly, there were a ton of people who, you know, worked very, very hard trying to educate Congress and policymakers in the administration and elsewhere that, look, the Innovation Act may work for a certain segment of the economic system, but not for a whole ton of others. And so I think you did have that whole ecosystem, the universities and manufacturers and venture capitalists, a whole bunch of people say, boy, you know, we're kind of nervous about some of these things. You really need to shift this out. And I remember one of the big questions in the Innovation Act was about customer stays. Do you remember this? And this is the idea that, you know, if you're a company and all you're doing is using a patented product and then you get sued for your use on it, you should be able to get a stay so that the person suing you can go after the real manufacturer of the patented product, if I remember correctly. And that sounds great in theory, but in practice, there are lots of problems with it. And I spent, I can't tell you how many hours sitting in negotiating rooms while we were doing the Innovation Act, trying to come up with some sort of compromise. And ultimately, it just became clear we were not going to be able to with the other side on this. So, I mean, I guess I'm telling you that just to say, like, we have never taken a religious view of this stuff. We are eager as well to squeeze out abuses in the system and target bad actors. We just were unwilling to do so in ways that we thought were going to harm the system overall.
And you talked about one of our major issues that, I guess, Innovation Alliance wants to see fixed is Section 101 patent eligibility. And I think there was a lot of optimism at the beginning of this Congress. There was finally a patent-friendly administration. Goodlatte and ISA were replaced in Congress by Collins and Jordan and Hank Johnson. There's a new Senate IP subcommittee to focus on these issues. The high-tech companies had, you could say, a lot of other things they needed to focus on. First, did you have that same optimistic, I guess, attitude in the beginning of this Congress, or is that kind of unrealistic to expect things to happen?
I've been doing this a long time, and I know how hard it is to come up with legislation. So I wouldn't say I was necessarily optimistic, but I mean, we tried very hard to try to come up with legislation, and it fell apart ultimately. And I saw Senator Tillis, or the Gene Quinn interviewed Senator Tillis yesterday, and I take nothing away from Senator Tillis. I'm very grateful for his interest in patents and IP, and he effectively said, well, the stakeholding community needs to compromise on this. I mean, the problem I see with that, to be honest, is, you know, one side of this debate is perfectly happy with the status quo. And unless there is any sort of pressure for there to be a resolution, it's very hard to come to a compromise. I mean, again, it comes back to the whole bargaining power thing. Like,
yeah,
if we're the demanders wanting change and the other side is like, look, we're perfectly happy where things are now, it's hard to kind of meet in the middle, I guess. And to his credit, again, you know, Senators Tillis and Coons tried to push that along. I can't criticize them at all for anything respect to that. It's just, you know, all I can say, I guess, is these things take time. And this is an area of the law, by the way, Section 101, which is, I mean, my God, if you want to say the AIA was complicated, Section 101 is extraordinarily detailed and complicated. And to get people excited or interested in it, it's quite a task.
Yeah. And I was actually going to ask you about that interview where, reading that interview, at least my perception was Senator Tillis basically said it's dead because everybody didn't want to come to us with the compromise. But do you think he got played by those opponents of changing the law? Because, like you said, they had no interest in compromise. And but he opened up the process by bringing everybody in. And they just, you know, they knew that if they could just delay it, it would never get done.
I mean, I don't think he was played. He's a very smart guy and a capable legislator. I just think the incentives are such that it's hard to come to a compromise. And look, I mean, these are still some of the largest companies in the world. Let me get rid of some. These are still the largest companies in the world, and they have an enormous amount of influence. And so, sure, any legislator is going to have to pay attention to what they say. But I would come back to just the fact this is really complicated stuff, even internally within the pro-patent community, I would say, the people who want to come up with a one-on-one compromise, it is hard for them all to get on the same page because they all view these things differently. And I mean, you saw this process with AIPLA and IPO and the ABA. They all spent years trying to come up with their compromise.
Wasn't helpful, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's just this stuff is super complicated. So even again, within people who can all sit around the table and say, I want there to be one-on-one language, even they have a hard time coming up with language that's all they're all can agree on. Now add into the mix people who really have no interest in there being any legislation at all. I mean, that's a very hard setup. So it didn't work.
I guess I want to have one more question about this question of compromise. I mean, you know the legislative process better than me, but you know, I look at some of the significant pieces of legislation that got passed: Hatch-Waxman Act, the Kent-Spam Act, Obamacare. Industry groups started compromising when they thought a bill is going to get passed with or without them. So, like, do people start compromising when they don't need to? I guess, is that the right kind of attitude to tell them, actually, if you guys never come to an agreement, don't worry about it. This bill will never
get
passed.
Bills come together any number of ways, truly. And, you know, if there's a must-pass vehicle, there's one train leaving the town, you know, people are going to, they're going to try to hop on it. And, you know, perhaps you are right. I haven't thought about it terribly too much. You know, why did that effort stall? I wouldn't say it's dead because there's still plenty of interest. I honestly believe at some point we're going to have to address 101 because it is such a handicap, I think, to our system. But I think it's just stalled in part maybe because there wasn't the imminence that we needed to do something by a particular period. You know, you have all these laws in Congress, tax laws that come to mind, where there's the bill or the law expires as of a certain date. They call them extenders. Oh, we need to pass the extenders by November 30th, because that's the day it ends. That's an action forcing event. And so everybody has to like figure out where they're going to be so they can pass this thing by that point. It doesn't always work, but it is at least an action forcing event. I don't know that there was a sufficient action of forcing event here. I'm not saying that there needed to be necessarily, but the debate did stall. And but again, all credit to Senator Tillis, Senator Coons, to Brad Watts, to everybody who was working on this. You know, they worked hard. And they spent a lot of time doing it, and I think got discouraged because it was hard and it is controversial even among the different groups.
And I guess next area I want to talk to you about is really what the coronavirus pandemic, what impact that's having on the IP policy debate. Some of the reactions I've been seeing bring to mind Rahm Emanuel's quote in 2018 or 2008, never let a good crisis to go to waste. And one of the crownstones of the effort I see is the open COVID pledge made by lots of companies who, I think it's fair to say, don't focus on innovating on anything related to dealing with pandemics. I guess, what do you think about that effort? And in general, I guess, when does somebody who's involved in public advocacy, when do you think something like that crosses into bad taste? Or do you think it has been effective?
First of all, I should say the Innovation Alliance has we've not taken a position on any of these things. We haven't really talked about it all that much. So I'm not speaking on behalf of the Innovation Alliance here. This is really just my thoughts. I mean, fundamentally, I want the patent system to reward innovation. I don't want people to start thinking patents are bad in any way. I think, my personal view, the fact that you have these voluntary private actors coming together and coming up with this COVID pledge, more power to them. I mean,
isn't it a PR effort? I mean, they're not.
I'm not going to question their motives. It could be, but I think they're perfectly entitled to do whatever they would like to do. I look, this is a tragedy where we all are now, and COVID-19 is a terrible thing. I wouldn't want anybody to be, using it for any kind of, advantage in that way. And I'm not at all saying the other side is. I'm just responding to your question about
it. Right. Yeah. So, sorry. Maybe I shouldn't have framed it like that.
I guess Brian Popper's view is private companies can do whatever they want. Where I have difficulty is when private companies seek to impose public policy that has broader societal ramifications to benefit their business model to the detriment of others who are, I think, performing very important work.
At least in the IP community, I've seen two reactions. One is, this is when we need to incentivize as much innovation as possible through a patent system. And the other one is, these patents are the ones that are hindering from us to be coming up with a solution to this problem. And that pledge kind of feeds into that latter story. Or otherwise, why would you, if they weren't the impediment, you wouldn't need this kind of pledge, they would voluntarily.
Yeah, I don't think there's any reason to think the patent system in some way in the near term here is having any impact or the long, frankly, in the long term, we have a patent system precisely so we can innovate. But again, private companies can get together and do whatever they would like to do. Where I think it becomes problematic again is where it bleeds into public policy. So if these companies were then to say, we should, mandate that companies have to join these patent pools like this, through legislative action, I think that would be more problematic.
And I guess, talking about public policy, there has been, maybe it's somewhat on the fringes, but there's been talk about, the government should seize patents related to that. One of your member companies, AbbVie, got kind of caught up in it. They came up with a drug. I'm sure they invest billions in research and development. And they eventually made a decision to, and it's a drug that thought might treat coronavirus. They made a decision. They said, we're not going to enforce those patents. Can you give us a little bit of insight into that? And once again, and I know you said there's a distinction between, private companies can decide what they want to decide and public policy, but these are games that everybody's kind of playing to kind of say, these pharmaceutical companies have too much patent rights and that's a problem, or vice versa.
Like we said, I hope people aren't using the current tragedy of COVID-19 for that end.
Yeah.
But I can't really speak in detail about the AbbVie decision. I hadn't talked with them about it. I mean, I saw it in the press like everybody else. But I will say, like, isn't that evidence of the fact that the system works? I mean, if they're voluntarily saying, look, we're going to let anybody kind of run and do this, what's the rationale for saying, okay, we got to seize these patents?
And I guess my concern is that if you believe in the patent system, I guess, does that disincentivize companies from investing in that if they know they're going to be forced either through public policy or through a PR campaign to give up those patent rights? And I guess...
Right. Like I said, longer term, the patent system exists to incentivize innovation. And, you know, there is much to criticize in the Supreme Court jurisprudence on patents. One of the topics I think you had mentioned was, you know, Justice Gorsuch's dissent in Thrive. I would also say his dissent in Oil States. If you go back and read the first paragraph of his dissent in Oil States, he really captures the kind of this idea that, look, imagine that you invent something. I mean, I think that's even how he starts it. He says, imagine you spend all of this money to develop an invention you had, and then the government comes in and says, okay, I'm going to take it, right? You don't really have any right to it. I'm blanking on the name, but it's just by the right of the government. You know, it's a public franchise. You get it just because we want you to have it. If we don't want you to have it, we'll take it away. That's not a great way to incentivize. We always say innovation, and I feel like that's not enough. Because again, people are going to innovate. They're going to come up with new ideas. It's, are they going to then take those ideas and spend all the money they need to make it into like real products? That's the problem I've always had with the people who argue, well, government money, you know, helped create all these various or helped fund basic research. And so therefore, inventions that come out of basic research should have somehow lesser rights, or they shouldn't have patent rights on it. But it's not really the basic research that gets you the patent, right? It's the incredible amount of time and effort and energy and money and all that, and developing and tweaking and perfecting the product that is then ultimately sold. And I feel like if we want to continue to incentivize companies to do that aspect of it, we've got to have a good, robust patent system. And I think we're suffering a little bit in that regard.
And I guess I wanted, before we finish with some hopefully fun questions, I wanted to ask you some of your advice as a, maybe putting aside your role at Innovation Alliance, but let's say you're a company and you don't know anything about how DC works or anything like that, but you think there's some law that's wrong. I mean, where should they start besides contacting you? I guess, what is your advice? Is it, you know, form a group, find the right lobbyist, you know, get a grassroots together?
It depends what the issue is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think people instinctively know that they should reach out to their representatives. And in my experience, I mean, representatives absolutely want to try to listen to their constituents and help them if they can. I mean, I think the problem when you are a member of Congress or a senator is you have 1,000 priorities presented to you every day.
Yeah.
How do you pick and choose among those priorities? And I think what guys like me try to do with clients is we try to help them figure out how to get the attention of a particular senator or member of Congress. That's where I think, you know, lobbyists, because we've worked and we understand how staff and members think, we can help channel that. But I don't think it's the case that, you know, if you got to hire a lobbyist in order to, you know, get your issue heard certainly by your constituents. I guarantee you, if you want and you have an issue you care about and you ask for a meeting with the people in the state who work for your member, you know, whoever represents you, I guarantee you, you'll get a meeting. People will pick up the phone, they'll call you. I think it just takes persistence. It takes, you know, having your facts straight, knowing exactly what you want. I can't tell you the number of times when I talk to people who aren't sophisticated in the ways of Washington, they care passionately about something, but the passion is all that comes through. The member, the staff on the other hand, has no idea what that person actually wants at the end of the day, right? So I always tell people, like, be passionate and be clear in what you want. Tell them exactly what it is that you want. Don't hang up the phone or leave the meeting with them not understanding what it is that you're asking for. I'd say that's the number one problem that people who are trying to get what they want, trying to get their way in Congress have, is that they're not clear about what they're actually asking for.
That's actually very good practical advice. You know, figure out what you want. That's probably the first step.
Yeah.
You know, actually, one of my previous guests was Josh Malone, who's the inventor of a bunch of balloons. This is something he said on my podcast, so I don't mind sharing it, but he said that he's obviously one of the most successful innovators, entrepreneurs from Texas, and he hasn't been able to get a meeting with his senators. I guess any advice for him? And I guess when he told me this, it kind of boggles my mind because, you know, it's not that hard to meet senators and congressmen in D.C. They don't always, I'm sure they're very busy people, but they're not.
Yeah, kings, it's hard to meet with senators. They are very busy people. Meeting with staff? Absolutely. I'd say it this way. My advice, and of course I know Josh and I respect him enormously for what, not only what he's invented, but the trials that he went through to realize the fruits of his invention. But I think it is far easier to talk to, meet a member of Congress or a senator back in their states or their home districts. Here in DC, it's a lot harder to meet with people like that. But it is, I mean, they have town halls, they meet with people, it's easier back in DC. So that'd be my advice as well, is to try to meet with them back in their home state. And frankly, it's better to meet with them in their home state because then they associate you, you are a constituent, as opposed to you're just another person knocking on my door asking for something here in Washington.
Yeah, I guess that's another interesting piece of advice, that if you're going to push for something on Capitol Hill, it's helpful to have a network of people around the country who are kind of pushing for it as well.
Oh.
From that perspective.
Well, you know, famously, all politics is local, right? So I think members, I know the popular understanding is, you know, oh, politicians, it's all money and influence. Truly, that's not my experience. And I've been doing this a long time. I mean, members, maybe a handful who have been convicted of corruption or other bad acts. But I mean, I'm telling you, every member I've ever had the pleasure of dealing with has cared deeply about getting the right policy and helping out the people they represent. I might have disagreed with them, right? I might have thought that they were wrong on what they thought was going to be best for them or even for their constituents. But I never thought that they were acting anything other than in what they thought was the best policy for America. I'm not so cynical as that. I don't think you need to, you know, write big checks. I think you just got to be persistent and try to meet them back home and be clear what you're asking for.
And that's good advice. I guess two last questions. One is, you've touched upon how it takes a while for legislation to get done, but there's people who have been worried about the patent system for a long time, and they don't see things changing in the way they want them to change. I guess any words of optimism, or do you think there's some people with just unreasonable expectations out there? And I guess what's your take on this?
I don't know. I mean, I think you have to keep fighting for what you believe. And I guess I'm not generally an optimist, I think, in my personal, you know, personality, but I'm an optimist in the sense that I think ultimately, you know, America will kind of stumble towards the right policy, maybe two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think we trend the right way. I think we are facing an historic, I mean, apart from the current very terrible situation we face with COVID-19, I think we face a real challenge with the rising power of China. Again, I come back to the fact that I am really at bottom an international trade attorney. This is a real challenge for the United States. I mean, we need to think hard about how we change our policies to meet that challenge. And I mentioned, not to be so gloom and doom, but I mentioned earlier that I feel like we're not really meeting that challenge yet with respect to 101. Last year, I'm sure you know this, for the first time, China has more international patents than the United States does. It's not a theoretical concern, for me at least. I mean, this is a real thing we have to focus on. China has a whole plan called Made in China 2025 for how it's going to dominate certain high-tech sectors going into the future. A plan they made in, I think, 2015, maybe. So they've got this long-standing, we're focusing on these, you know, artificial intelligence, biotechnology. The United States does not have a plan like that, and I'm not sure it make sense in the context of a liberal democracy for us to have a plan like that. But we can try to shore up the mechanisms that have delivered us the economy that we have today. I would argue one of those would be to really strengthen the patent system in ways that I think it has been weakened over the course of the last decade or so, in order to help meet that challenge going forward. We don't have industrial policy like China has. What we do have are incentives and structures that allow our companies to grow and compete. A critical piece of that has been the patent system. And I think we've allowed it to deteriorate to a degree that it really deserves attention now. And that's what the Innovation Alliance is trying to do, is to try to call attention to the ways in which we think the system needs to be strengthened to meet that challenge and just help the entire American economy.
That makes sense. Last question. What advice would you give to a law school student or young attorney who wants to become the next Brian Pomper, run an advocacy group focused on patent issues?
Yeah, don't. That's what I would say. I recognize I'm very fortunate to be in the position where I'm in, but my advice to younger people is always runs along these lines, which is that life is long and few people follow a straight line path. So if you are a good student and you've always succeeded in school and you're driven and you're ambitious, chances are you have a plan for yourself, right? I'm going to go to this college and then this graduate school or law school, and then I'm going to get this job, and I'm going to, you know, I've got this straight line plan for myself. In my experience, almost nobody follows that path. And the people, ironically, who are the most ambitious and the most hardworking tend to be the hardest on themselves when they deviate from that path. And my advice to younger people is cut yourself a break, because the you of 22, 25, 30 even is different from the you at 40, 45, 50. I turned 50 actually a week from today.
Happy early birthday.
Yeah, thank you. Milestone for me. And I'm telling you, I don't think if I had told my 30-year-old self, hey, you're going to be doing what you're doing now, I wouldn't even have known what you were talking about. But the truth is, you have this plan, you get deviated because you're interested in things that come up along the way. And that's good. That's positive. Follow those interests, and they will inevitably lead you to a place where you're reasonably happy. Most people, even though they go through hard struggles and difficulties and insecurities and self-doubt, certainly I'm not immune to any of that. But ultimately, I find most people find their way to some sort of equilibrium where they're more or less happy with where they've ended up. So how do you become Brian Pomper? I don't know. You focus on the things that you're interested in and be open to new opportunities. I'd say take risks. In my life, I've taken a few very big risks, for instance, leaving the Hill and starting a company from scratch. I was terrified, right? I'm no incredibly brave or entrepreneur. I was terrified, but I kept having this mantra to myself, fortune favors the bold. You're not going to hit a home run if you don't swing for the fences. And I'm lucky that it's worked out for me. It might not have, right? It might have gone another way, but I'm confident that, you know what, I would have picked up and I would have ended up somewhere else, and I would have been happy wherever I ended up. I guess that's my advice for younger people who are trying to enter the policy space and do the sorts of things that, you know, we do.
That's great advice. Thank you so much for doing this, Brian.
Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.